session number 16716, Canon Gervais Markham, reel 4.
Canon Markham, Reel 4. What were your first impressions of Egypt?
My first impressions of Egypt were of sand and dirt and dust, because we were, our unit was camped in transit camps with nothing particular to do except to wait for orders. We were a medical unit, but with no medical function whatever. So it was a question of hanging about and trying to occupy ourselves till we had something definite. We were moved from the transit camp at Suez up to the shores of the Mediterranean at a place called Sidi Bish, just outside Alexandria. And this was a more civilized place. It was the same sort of sandy camp. The tents were what were called EPIP, I remember, big square tents, very solid and comfortable. We had an officer's mess, of course, in one, and some local contractor fed us quite well, no doubt at exorbitant expense. The men were looked after well, but the only occupation was to go into Alexandria, and so this gave those of us who were historically inclined a chance to see the historical sites of Alexandria, and the men visited certain other establishments which are collectively known as Sister Street, I remember, and there was the best meeting place was a place called Grothy's, which had a particularly succulent lot of sweets and chocolate cakes, which was the great attraction in the afternoon. And then there were, of course, hotels and bars and things in the evening, and the local entertainments. But we were just waiting, doing nothing in particular, at this transit camp outside Alexandria for some time.
At this point, Canon, may I ask about the organization of a casualty clearing station?
Yes. Well, that is a bit of army administration. It's designed for when you are on active service during a battle, when the frontline troops have got with their unit a medical officer and an RAP, a regimental aid post. This is where the casualties first come in and are dealt with by the MO of the unit, and then they are sent further back to a field ambulance, which is a proper medical unit, which will deal with stretcher cases brought back from the front line and is highly mobile. From the field ambulance, casualties are taken further back to a casualty clearing station, which is perhaps at corps level, and there it is more of almost a hospital with a medical unit of 8 doctors and 100 men. And from the casualty clearing station, they are cleared, perhaps by rail, to a general hospital. So you have the RAP to field ambulance to casualty station to hospital. But how this actually operates depends very much on the type of warfare that is going on. Our particular unit, number 2 casualty clearing station, since I joined it, you see, in Rotherham, had no patients whatever, had done nothing. And the doctors and orderlies, and surgeons, were all skilled people who had nothing whatever to do. And it was only when we had done our waiting about outside Sidi Bish, that we were then put in a train and taken up to Haifa in Israel, in Palestine, as it then was.
Before we go to that,
yes.
Can I just ask about the status, in the sense, the ranking that was held within the unit? You said yes. A colonel was in command.
There'd be a colonel in charge of the unit.
Would he necessarily be a medical person?
Well, he would probably be a regular RAMC officer, which means that in his youth he had been qualified as a doctor, but that in practice, in peacetime, all he had done was to administer the army routine, that is to see about the pay and conditions and the paperwork of running a unit, and exercise discipline, of course, in his unit. The people who actually did the hands-on medical work were the 8 officers, I think there were 8 certainly in ours, who were civilian doctors, recently come from very busy practices somewhere in England, and had been put into uniform, but were still at heart doctors, and interested in their patients rather than in military administration. So you can imagine they were getting a bit fed up with doing nothing whatever that they had been trained to do and for which they'd been, what they were being paid to do in the army, without a doctor, without any patients.
Were they necessarily specialists or just general practitioners?
Well, there was a mixture. They had to be surgeons, of course. Very, 2 or 3 very skilled surgeons we had. Dabru, I remember, was one of them. Others were GP. It would be a mixture of specialities. There'd be that you had 8 different types of medical officer in this one casualty clearing station.
Yeah. Below them, after the doctors who came into the...
Then there would be presumably a sergeant major and some sergeants and 100 men. They would be, of course, for the... They were not trained as doctors or even in hospitals. They were to do the practical job of setting up a casualty clearing station. That is, you've got to have equipment, you've got to have catering, you've got to have food, you've got to have transport, you've got to have protection, you've got to have security, you've got to have the people who would actually put up your tents or set your stall out in a building, whatever it is, the rations, the weapons, of course, you're a non-fighting unit, but you have to be protected. And these 100 men, they would also be people who would carry the stretchers do the... Some would be the specialist orderlies, as in a hospital. A doctor cannot do an operation unless he's got a supporting staff of people who will bring the patients in. They have... You make the equipment do, and the nurses. Now, there were nurses. I can't remember exactly whether they were attached to our unit or not. They were not part of the casualty clearing station. There were some who came out in our troop ship with us, but they were not part of our actual unit. But when we opened up, as we shall come to a little later on, and actually got patients, then there would be these women nurses who were there to do the nursing side of the medical work.
And your role within this would be to secretary...
My role as a chaplain, we were there as doing the work of what you might call a hospital chaplain. A clergyman goes around visiting in a hospital, and talks to the patient and looks after their spiritual, moral welfare, or possibly their social, family, pastoral care as well. From them as people, their worries are about their families, their wives, their children, and the chaplain is, as it were, a liaison between the patient and his other concerns, which are not medical concerns. But anybody who is in hospital knows that the actual you're being treated medically is only part of your recovery. It's yourself as a person and all your other interests. The chaplain is involved in all of these.
Do you recall any of the personalities or particular personalities of this unit?
I haven't any particular memories of individual people. They were. We became friends as we fed together for so long, but none of them stands out in my memory that I can give any interesting information about. Neither of the officers nor of the men, really.
Were the facilities at Sidibish pretty wide, varied? I think in terms of. It was a transit and relief camp, wasn't it?
It was a large transit camp. It was a huge sandy area, covered with tents of different kinds. Each unit, well, some were whole units were camped there. Some it was a transit camp for individuals. But it was pleasant enough. The weather was good. It was hot weather. It was possible to bathe in the sea. It wasn't an unpleasant place at all. And of course thousands of people went through it.
Had you a picture of the desert, and was it different from the actual fact?
Oh, this was not the desert. This was the suburbs of Alexandria. We haven't got anywhere near the desert yet. That will come later.
Yeah. How long were you at Sidibish?
Till 2 or 3 months, but in July where we at last got a chance of doing something active. And we were posted to Haifa in Palestine, which was just at the end of the Syrian campaign, which mainly the Australians had been conducting, but that the fighting was still going on and casualties were coming down from Syria to Haifa. Our unit took over an Italian hospital in Haifa, quite well-equipped, substantial civilian building. And there, for the first time, we were able to treat casualties. It was a proper hospital with proper wards. I don't know what happened to the Italians who had been there before, but we had the complete running of this civil hospital, and the casualties came in by ambulance from down the coast from Syria and came to us for a short time, I suppose. And then we were only a casualty clearing station, that is, we were to treat people as they came and then pass them on to a general hospital. So they were transitory patients on the way through from the field ambulance to the hospital. To the main hospital, which was somewhere else, perhaps in Jerusalem, perhaps they were sent down to Egypt, where the main general hospitals were.
Were casualties heavy?
Not really. It was a curious war that I don't really know very much about what was happening in Syria, but we had the casualties through. I visited them as they came through, as one does just in hospital. I have here a note, an interesting sample of what our army is composed of. I said, in the surgical ward today, out of 14 men, I came across the following: a Lithuanian Jew, a Polish Jew who had been a blacksmith in Jerusalem, a Palestinian Arab from a remote village, unable to read or write, an Algerian who for 4 years had been serving in the French army, a Cypriot muleteer who spoke only Greek and was deaf at that, 2 Australians who had never been abroad before, a South African now serving in the Royal Navy, 2 Scotsmen and 3 Englishmen. That is what the army was composed of, people coming through our hospital. Yeah. So this was interesting because at least our doctors were having a chance of treating patients, and so we had a civilian mess in the hospital, and it was quite a civilian life, just being as it might be in an English hospital.
What are the needs, if in general terms, what are the needs of a man who's wounded in battle, horrific situation, obviously hurt and hurting? Is there a need that comes through for a padre or chap like yourself to deal with, or found yourself dealing with?
Well, the needs of a wounded man are, first of all, to be have his wounds treated, and to be assured of personal attention, and he's being treated as an individual, getting individual care from people who are professionally qualified to deal with him. He hasn't any particular spiritual needs for the chaplain, unless he is in grave danger, if he's serious, or he's afraid of dying, or is likely to die. Then perhaps you might get some spiritual need about life and death. But it's interesting how very seldom this really actually happens with a chaplain, certainly in a casualty clearing station. He is not dead. He may be seriously wounded, but he's being on his way through to a hospital. Probably what he wants most is for his family to be assured that he is all right. And so very often the chaplain can write to his family, but in those particular circumstances this was difficult because a letter took 3 months to get from Palestine to England, and he wouldn't get any answer. But there was a sort of air letter service which you could send. There were coded messages you could send, but in that particular hospital it was very difficult to correspond with people in England.
How long were you there?
I was there for several months during that summer, but then one night visiting round the wards, I found there was a major general in one of the beds. I've forgotten what was wrong with him, maybe just having a rest cure in a comfortable bed, but I got talking with him, and he discovered, he was an old Wickhamist, and I was an old Wickhamist, and finally he said, well, what are you doing in a unit like this? You ought to come and be my unit. I've got the cavalry division. You must come and join my division. So I said, I'm perfectly happy here, but, oh, no, he said, no, a chap like you must go. I'll have you posted to the Warwickshire Yeomanry. So, a little later on, I was posted I left the casualty clearing station and found I was chaplain to the Warwickshire Yeomanry, who were part of the cavalry division that, believe it or not, had gone out to the Middle East at the beginning of the Second World War with their horses. And they had been in operation with their horses in the Syrian campaign, and were now, and they'd been across to Iraq and back, apparently. There was a story that they'd actually had a cavalry charge at one point, but now they were camping in Palestine. Their horses had been taken away from them, except for the officers who kept some chargers, and they'd been given little tanks known as honey tanks. So I went to join them in a camp at Gedera, and found that I was part of an officer's mess in which there were 5 masters of foxhounds in the mess. and it was a complete a yeomanry cavalry unit which was still operating by bugle call, by trumpet calls, because they were cavalry, not infantry. So we got up to every morning to a cavalry reveille played on the trumpet, and we weren't doing anything particular there. It was near Salafand on the rolling sandy parts of Palestine, but they were training with little honey tanks, tiny things. You would get a couple of men inside. The only time I've ever actually driven a tank, I remember, I was allowed to drive one of these little things about. It was not a very good weapon of war. Its armor plate was so thin that any gun shell would go through it. But it was the best that they could be given at that particular time. The officers, many of them, were all hunting men, being from a yeomanry regiment, and kept a yeomanry regiment. They kept their horses, and they would ride round the countryside as they did at home. It was a very feudal atmosphere, straight from the heart of Warwickshire. And I was the chaplain, and there was and I visited the, of course, the troopers in their tents, and I discovered that swearing like a trooper was in fact exactly what it meant. They had only one adjective. It seems extremely dull. But they were friendly enough to me. Then we went, we camped at Acre, A-C-R-E, for some time, near Haifa.
Did the unit have a number, a designation?
It was the Warwickshire Yeomanry. That was it, the regiment on its own, yes.
Who was the Major General? Do you recall his name?
I can't remember what his name was, no. Afraid. Don't suppose I met him again. Oh, I probably met him on one occasion, because it was in that summer we had an Old Wickhamist dinner at Jerusalem. I've forgotten who it was that organized it, but somebody who'd been at Winchester said we must have an Old Wickhamist dinner. And so with the various grapevine went round, I suppose 20 or 30 of us had a dinner in an hotel in Jerusalem, and the principal Old Wickhamist in the Middle East at that time was Wavell, but he'd just gone off to be commander-in-chief in India, so we sent him a loyal telegram. I remember myself and another man who was an archaeologist, somehow, we composed a telegram in Latin, which was sent through army's signals to the commander-in-chief in India. I hope it actually got to him. It was an elegant telegram, I remember. But apart from that, it was just training with the Warwickshire Yeomanry. We did cross-country running, I remember. We had to keep active in some way. I found that my experience of doing my exercise at Winchester as a youth, being accustomed to doing running as part of my ordinary exercise, stood me in good stead. And with all these troopers, I found that though I was presumably 10 years older than most of them, I was quite able to keep up with them as a cross-country runner.
What date would this be that you went to
Acre? This is in July to October 1941.
Do you recall who commanded the unit?
Yes, I do. Colonel Jackson. He was a master of foxhounds, as so many of them were. We got on perfectly well, but I don't think he thought very much of me as a chaplain. My predecessor had been a clergyman who lived in Warwickshire and knew them and was himself a hunting man. I was not a hunting man, so I wasn't quite regarded as being the right sort of person to be in a yeomanry mess, a bit too much of a clergyman rather than a hunter. But we went...
Can I ask you, yes, since you've mentioned it, can I ask you how the mess was organized and ran?
the mess. Well, yes, there was one of the officers was the mess officer, and with the quartermaster, he would make arrangements with some local contractor, so that we didn't feed on rations. Well, these we had the rations, of course, the same as troops, but these were supplemented by private purchase from local shops, so that we had a rather higher standard of living in the officers' mess than would have for the ordinary troopers.
And would this be just a tent?
Yes, just a marquee fitted up as a mess tent. We had our individual bivvy tents. I had a little bivvy tent thing which just I could just get inside and slept on the ground. No, I think I had a camp bed inside it, as a matter of fact. Yes, I got somebody to put little flaps on my bivvy tent so that it could be raised and higher poles so that I could get a camp bed inside it and keep the sleep off the ground. It's a great advantage.
Do you pay a mess fee?
Then you'd pay a mess, yes, you paid so much for extra messing. And you paid for your drinks, of course, and these would be supplied and you'd sign for them, and every month you'd have a mess bill which you would have to pay. Of course, some of these men were fairly heavy drinkers. That was their custom in civil life. Me being only a curate and very small pay, I'd never been a drinking man. I just couldn't afford it. So I didn't become a drinking man in the army particularly. Though I had a drink in the mess, same as everybody else did, but as economically as possible.
Was there a ritual in the running or the organizer, whatever you go doing in the mess?
Well, ordinary, yes, mess traditions. You always address the colonel as colonel, the others by the Christian names. You don't wear your Sam Brown in the mess. Of course, I didn't wear Sam Brown, so it didn't affect me. But there were no formal dinners in the sense of Victorian mess life. It was just all quite informal in that way. You didn't have toasts and meals. You were very glad to get a meal. Informal mess life, you'd say. Yeah.
Acre itself, Acre, was it a pleasant area?
Acre, yes, that was a camp outside the little town of Acre. Acre is, of course, a very historic place as being the last place where the Crusaders were able to hold on to before they were turned out of Palestine. And it's a wonderful, still medieval city within its walls and has at that time, certainly, it was almost completely unspoiled. It was quite a little medieval city. We were outside the walls, where Richard Coeur de Lion had camped before us, and it was just a sandy plain with tents. I think there were huts in some, because I had a little hut which I made into a sort of chapel, a chaplain's chapel, and I had services there, and I ran classes, confirmation classes, and padre's hours, and so on, in my little hut. Prepared men for confirmation. That was my job. And doing various educational work, because obviously a regiment of yeomanry, it's not actually in action, has nothing particular to do, training. With these honey tanks.
Had the unit seen any action up to now?
Yes, it had been in the Syrian campaign. They had gone across to Iraq somehow or other and come back again. So that they felt they were a unit that had seen active service, whereas I never really had seen active service. I was still green. You see, I hadn't seen a shot fired in anger in any sort of way. at that time.
Mm. Had you had any thoughts, personal thoughts, about what it might be like in action and how you might react?
Well,
because it was a danger that it was coming somewhere.
It was going to come some time. Yes. Well, all I'd I suppose had was burying people who'd been killed in air raids. I had a contact. We'd had air raids in England, but I'd never been in action against an enemy, and I didn't really know quite what I would have to do. From time to time, we had the colonel would take us out on a toot. You've probably never heard of a toot. T-E-W-T stands for Tactical Exercise Without Troops. And we would go out, and he would imagine a scenario of a battle of some sort, and tell the officers, of course, of the different unit squadrons, have to say what they would do, where they would take their men, and then the colonel takes me, well, now, Padre, what would you be doing? Because I didn't know what I'd be doing then. Well, of course, you'd be burying the casualties. Now, where would you bury them? Come along now. So I had to think hurriedly what I would do if I had some casualties to bury and where I would choose to put them and that sort of thing.